Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Ellen Mirapol. Am I saying that correctly?
You are.
Ellen is the author of the previous novels, The Lost Women of Azalea Court, Her Sister's Tattoo, Kinship of Clover, On Hurricane Island, and House Arrest, and the play Gridlock. She's the guest editor for the anthology Dreams for a Broken World and has published widely essays and stories. Her work focuses on the lives of women, especially those on the fault lines between political activism and family. She has won many prizes and been a finalist for many prizes and lives in Western Massachusetts, where she's a founding mother of Straw Dog Writers Guild. And the book that we're looking at today is Somewhere an Island. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Ellen. Or Sometimes an Island. Sorry, Sometimes an Island. Welcome to Writers' Voices. How are you today?
Thank you so much. I'm delighted to be here.
So Sometimes an Island is, tell us what the kind of the overarching story is.
Well, it's a mosaic novel or a novel in stories told in many voices and several different timelines. It's set in the dozen or so years leading up to and following a major climate disaster. The novel traces one family's past escape from their burning village in Russia to settle on an island off the coast of Maine. And a century later, their descendants flee again due to rising sea levels.
So I'm guessing that climate change and the environmental issues are something that you are very interested in.
You would be correct.
How did you come to get so involved with those issues?
Initially, by chance, one of my roommates in college was one of the organizers for the very first Earth Day in 1970. And so she dragged us all along. And I became interested at that point, but I didn't become obsessed about it until the birth of my first grandchild, which was 18 years ago. And at that point, I started really worrying about what the future might hold for her as she grew older.
Yeah.
So I joined a climate study group, and the more I learned, the more I worried. And then I started writing about it, because as a novelist, you often write about the things that keep you up at night.
Yeah. So this, Sometimes an Island, tell me what the title means.
Well, I don't have a really good answer for that, Monica. Titles are very hard, and the title actually comes from one of the stories in the mosaic novel, the linked stories. But as an interviewer pointed out to me a couple of days ago, we often think of, no man is an island, and the isolation that we can face. And in fact, one of the things that this book does explore is how people working together can reduce that isolation and reduce the potentials, particularly if climate change continues to get as bad as scientists tell us it may, it will. What can we do about it? Can we work together to mitigate things?
When there's also a specific island that this book kind of focuses on,
yes.
And tell us a little bit about that island. And is it a real island?
Well, it's a fictional version of a real island. When I started writing fiction, which was in midlife, my husband and I rented a little house on an island in the middle of Penobscot Bay called Vinyl Haven. We knew it as a vacation area, but we rented our house there for 2 months, not during prime vacation time. And so it's where I started writing fiction, and it's a place that's very, very dear to me. I have taken huge liberties with the inhabitants of the island to write not only this book, but several of my previous books are set or partially set there. But it's the physical setting of the place that is so magical to me, and is, I have tried to render that as accurately as I can.
And what do you call the island in your books?
You know, in my book, it is part of a group of three islands called the Three Sisters. And that's really the way I have described it. My second novel on Hurricane Island and Hurricane Island is actually not this particular one, but one of the other Three Sisters is set entirely there. And that's where I go over as much of the island history as possible. This one is really focused on the island as a place where the settlers landed and then must leave.
And so this was, they had escaped from pogroms, right?
Correct.
In yes. Russia?
Yes.
So these were Russian Jewish families that came here. And what year would that have been?
The early years of the 20th century.
Okay. And so that is accurate to the history of this island that you, this actual island, or this is something that you made up?
That is made up. That okay. is some of my family history superimposed on the real place.
Okay. Okay. And so where did your family actually emigrate to?
They came through Ellis Island and settled in New York.
In New York.
Lower East Side and then Brooklyn. Yes.
Okay. So in sometimes an island, you've got kind of three friends or cousins, and it's like never really clear if they're related mm-hmm. or not, that came over, David, Levi, Jacob Saperstein, and Abel Eisenfeld. And then their descendants are all on this, on the island. And, or not all, obviously some have left mm-hmm. over the years, I'm sure, but they still have a really tight community there. And so when the novel opens, one of the matriarchs of that family line has left the island.
Mm-hmm.
Why did she do that?
Because of rising sea levels.
Yeah.
So Sadie and her husband decide that island life is probably not sustainable and decide to move inland. And that's really how the novel opens.
Yeah. And another interesting kind of repeating theme among these different stories is the idea of communal living. So mm-hmm. they have set up this homestead
mm-hmm.
In central Maine, right? That, and they are trying to get other people to come and live there kind of basically communally.
Correct.
Now, do you have any experience with communal living?
I do in the past,
yeah.
yes.
So what was, tell me a little bit about that and how that influenced this book.
I lived in a a cooperative, a commune, during and after college, and then later on in a second setting once I had moved to Massachusetts. I've always been fascinated by it because I think that communal living can bring out the best in us as human beings. It can, unfortunately, also bring out the not so wonderful parts, which makes it pretty dramatic, and something that lends itself well, I think, to fiction.
Yeah. So when do you think that people, that there are a lot of these intentional communities springing up now? Is this my dad was kind of into that idea back in the 70s, and
yep.
He never actually did it, but he definitely explored it. The back to the land, ended up buying land in Iowa because we lived in eastern Pennsylvania and it was too expensive to buy land there. So he bought land in Iowa, where my mother was from, and we all moved to Iowa when I was in high school. He was eventually intending to have a homestead and live off the land there. But unfortunately, he died at age 49 and wasn't able to completely realize that dream, although he did a lot on that property. And but then it seems like that whole kind of back to the land movement sort of fell out of favor for a while. But mm-hmm. Is there a resurgence of it now, do you think?
I don't know if there's a resurgence of it. What I have seen is a kind of an offshoot of it, and that's the co-housing movement, where people own their individual homes, but they are very connected in terms of taking care of them, often co-owning a common house with extra guest rooms and a big kitchen. They cooperate to clear the snow and plant the gardens so every family doesn't have to have a lawnmower and a snowblower. And I think that, and they make a lot of decisions by consensus. And I think that those are very common, at least in the area where I live. And I think they are certainly a form of communal living, but one that does allow for a little bit more privacy,
right.
A little bit more autonomy for a family.
It makes a lot of sense, because it's like, why does everyone need to spend a lot of money to have guest rooms that you use once or twice a year? Mm-hmm. And when you can have some shared, like where I am right now in Austin, I have a condo here, and we have in the condo development, we have a guest suite that mm-hmm. you can reserve. You have to pay for it, but it's cheaper than a hotel. And so if you have guests coming, you can have them stay in the guest suite mm-hmm. if it's available. And that makes a lot of sense. And of course, condos also have shared gym facilities so that everybody doesn't have to go out and buy their exercise equipment. And so in a sense, that's a little bit of communal living. And it can be annoying when you have these rules, the HOA rules.
Yep.
But it makes a lot of sense too. And we have a building link where people will say, oh, does anyone have a ladder? I need a ladder. Does anyone have a pair of pliers and we borrow back and forth, and rather than everybody having to have everything. So,
right.
Yeah. So Ellen, tell us a little bit about the kind of the main storylines in this linked story novel. We already talked about Sadie leaving the island and setting up this homestead. So that's one main line. Would you say there's three?
Well, there are three settings. And okay. I think that the settings in some ways are an organizing device for the novel. So there's the community on the island, and several of the stories are set there over time. There's the homestead in rural Maine, and that is where the novel begins and where it ends. And there's the collective, the cooperative, which is in Western Massachusetts and is a collection of people who are building an off-the-grid community in an urban setting. So, and there, several of the people in the collective are involved in a political action, which I don't really want to describe too much about, but which does result in a major grid failure. And some collateral damage from that. But in many ways, this sort of organizing plot is, as I said, leading up to and then following a climate disaster called the Great Undoing of 2029. And that is really what drives much of the novel.
And 2029 isn't very far away.
No, it isn't, is it? No. It was a lot farther away when I started writing this book.
I was going to say, when did you start writing?
4 or 5 years ago.
There are definitely some sections of it, some parts of it that make me think that that the president that we currently have was the president when you were writing some of this.
Yes.
Yeah. As you were writing, were you like incorporating things that were happening in the world at that time into the storyline?
Probably not consciously, but there's no way that you don't, you know, subconsciously include, as I said, the things that keep you up at night. And certainly many of those things that were happening were keeping us up at night, worrying about it. But, you know, originally these were separate stories. And some of them a couple had been previously published, most had not. And I started out to just write some short stories for a collection. And then I realized that the new stories I was writing were also very connected to the ones I already had, and that these stories all wanted to play together. And that it became clear to me that there was a through narrative. And so I ended up then writing more to link the stories together in a more sort of whole way.
Mm. Okay, so how far in, like how much of this did you have written when you realized this was going to be a novel and not just short stories?
Probably about half of it.
Really? Really?
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
You said you started writing fiction in midlife. Did you start out writing novels or writing short stories?
I started writing short stories because that's pretty much what everyone does as a beginning fiction writer. But they kept wanting to become novels. So, you know, the first stories I wrote ended up growing up into novels.
Do you feel like, you know, writing about the environmental crisis, are you trying to change people's minds, to encourage, to motivate them to action?
You know, I think what good fiction can do is ask questions that are provocative to people, to make people think about the characters and the story. I don't think fiction does such a good job at telling people what to think or what to do. When it does, it becomes didactic. And as a reader, when I read something that gets preachy, I want to throw it across the room. It doesn't work for me. So I try very hard not to set out to tell people what to do. I do want to goose people into thinking about these issues. I want people to think about, you know, what's happening with the environment. I want people to think about migration and immigration and what it means that people all around the world are fleeing their homes, not only because of climate change, but also because of famine and drought and hunger and war and violence. And, you know, these are big things in our world today. So, yes, I hope that people will consider them. But I think that what fiction does best is to help us feel empathy for lives very different from our own, to help us see things from a different perspective. And that's what I try to accomplish in my books.
Wow. Why don't you read a little bit from Sometimes an Island for us, Ellen?
I would love to. I think maybe I'll read the prologue and from the beginning to sort of talk more about some of the things we've touched on in our
Perfect.
Conversation. So this is the prologue. In the early years of the 20th century, pogroms against Jews escalate in the Pale of Settlement, the portion of the vast Russian Empire where Jews are allowed to live. After Cossacks attack their families and burn their homes, three young men and a girl escape from a shtetl near Odessa and settle on an island in Penobscot Bay, Maine. Over a century later, some of their descendants flee rising sea levels to homestead in central Maine, calling themselves climate refugees. They are joined by a cousin from Massachusetts and members of her co-op, which split apart when a member was sent to prison as an eco-terrorist. The island, the homestead, the co-op. Three communities fleeing danger. Three intentional families facing the great undoing of 2029. This first story is called Drowning in Maine, and it's narrated by Sadie. I am jittery, waiting for them to arrive, which should be soon, assuming they remembered the map. You won't have cell service once you leave town, I told Mark and Evelyn several times. Of course, once they get here, our worries aren't over. Can this place support all of us? Will the seven of us be able to stand each other? David and I moved to Maine a year ago. I've questioned that decision every single day. What will our son's family think about our little homestead? Will my granddaughters appreciate the four shelves of young adult novels on the floor-to-ceiling bookcases, or the stacks of puzzles and board games? I run my fingers across the long pine table we lugged here from the island, feeling the scratches and gouges from generations of family meals and art projects and science fair experiments. There's room to feed all the kin I hope to gather here. I sweep ashes from the hearth onto the fireplace, then straighten the nesting Matryoshka dolls lined up in descending size along the pine mantelpiece. They are our family totem, our legacy, rescued by my great-grandmother when she fled the Cossacks. On the dolls' stylized painted faces, I superimpose the expressions of my grandchildren, five generations removed from the Pale of Settlement. Twins, Rosie and Eloise, and their older sister, Tilly. The nesting dolls have always lived on the family mantle, handed down from grandmother to granddaughter on her 16th birthday. I touch my index finger to my lips and then to the face of the smallest doll. David and I grew up on an island in the middle of Penobscot Bay. We're cousins, not unusual with the limited gene pool in places like ours. We have always lived on the island, never even dreamed of leaving, though I wasn't surprised when our children moved away. Our quirky house wasn't just our home. It was our history, built by my great-grandparents from blocks of the granite that drove the island economy back then. We raised our children in these drafty rooms, and my elderly mother still lives there. I miss that house and the island, the slanted floors, the rocky coast, the low tide aroma, the quarries abandoned to swimming, the certainty of tides. How could we leave our history behind? Because it became personal that global warming wasn't just another political cause. It was life-threatening, and it was now. So we bought these 20 acres on the mainland with plans to gather our family there sometime in the near future. Another fleeing, another migration. When that 130 square chunk of Greenland's ice cap broke off in the Northeast Arctic last year, I took it very personally. I'm no climate expert like my daughter-in-law, Evelyn, but that much ice melting in the oceans translates into big trouble for people living on islands or near a river like our Brooklyn family. Very soon, neither of those places will be sustainable. David and I decided it was time to heed the warning. We retired and moved inland. So maybe this latest ice chunk didn't drown us all, but the next one could, or the one after that, or massive wildfires, or drought, or another big grid failure like the one a few years ago. In any case, it galvanized us to leave our home and begin gathering our clan. We adore our family, every one of them, even Tilly, who's going through her less than mellow adolescence. I couldn't believe it when Mark and Evelyn agreed to join us, and so suddenly. But can we live with them? I guess we'll find out.
And that was Ellen Mirapol reading from Sometimes an Island. Now, this book was published by Sea Crow Press. And who are they, and how did you find them?
They are a small indie publisher based on Cape Cod, and they really focus on books that are close to nature and focus on our environmental world, focus on setting. My first five novels were published by another publisher. But for this one, I wanted to stay sort of close to home, not do a lot of travel, trying to keep my carbon footprint small. So I found Sea Crow, and they really loved the book, and I loved them, and it's been a delightful process.
So did you more of book touring with your other books?
I did. I did the thing of getting on airplanes and going all around the country.
Wow.
Until COVID. One of my books came out a month before COVID started. So needless to say, that was all very disappointing and a lot of Zoom events.
So what inspired you to start writing fiction? And did you have other writing experience before that?
You know, I was a writer as a kid. I wrote very bad poetry, and I was the features editor and wrote the features column in my high school newspaper. Actually, my first publication was when I was 12, when my parents were very avid square dancers, and they went out almost
every. So were
every
mine.
Oh, no kidding! Really?
Yes.
But I would end up making dinner for my sister and me all the time. And I wrote an essay called I Am a Square Dance Orphan. And my parents didn't much like it, but they were supportive and they helped me get it published in a national square dance magazine.
Oh, how cute.
But I didn't start writing fiction until my 50s, and I had always been a voracious reader. And you know, if you read a lot, sometimes you finish a book and you say, oh, I wish I'd written that. It's so good. Or sometimes I would say, I bet I could do that. And at some point in my early 50s, I said, if I'm going to ever try, I'd better start now. So I did. I took a couple of online writing workshops and then made the big leap and rented this place on the island for 2 months to write every day.
Now, did you leave another career to do that?
Well, I didn't leave the other career right away, but I was a pediatric nurse practitioner and a job that I loved. And I continued to do both. I did a low residency MFA in fiction writing. And, you know, low residency programs are designed for people who have other full-time work. And so I did both for, oh, I don't know, 5-6 years, and then decided to take an early retirement from my medical career. And I started working part-time in a bookstore so I could learn that part of the writing publishing world and wrote.
So some of the characters in Sometimes an Island have some similar career journeys. You've got a nurse practitioner. Is there one or two of them in this book?
Yes. It's a terrific career and I loved it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure, but did one of them also go work in a bookstore in this book?
No, it was another character
another
who went
character.
And worked in a bookstore. But what can I say? You know, writing fiction is a wonderful stew of imagination, experience, memories, and just plain dreaming out loud. You know.
So, So you did that 2 month kind of sabbatical pretty early in the process in your writing process.
Yes.
And so you were still, you took 2 months off from work to do that?
Yeah. You know, my husband and I, he wanted to write a book as well. And so we both took sabbaticals from our job. Now hospitals don't know from sabbaticals, you know, it's not something they do, but I had enough vacation time saved up. So that they were willing to let me do it. And we did. And we shared a laptop. We only had one laptop at that point. But we took turns writing longhand and writing on the laptop. And we wrote until one or two every day, then made lunch and took a long hike to a pretty place on the island where we talked about what we'd written that day. And it was just an amazing 2 months. And then we'd go back and watch sunset with a glass of wine. And it was really pretty idyllic way to start writing.
So how far did you get on your first novel during that? Or no, you were doing short stories at that point, right?
Yeah, I wrote two or three complete short stories during that time. Two of which actually became part of my first novel, and a third one became part of really the first novel manuscript I wrote, but one that took 20 years before it was finally ready for publication. I just kept going back to it. It took me a really long time to figure out how to write that book.
So you set out writing short stories. Your husband was trying to write a novel or a nonfiction book, or what was he working on?
He was writing a political memoir. He was essentially taking speeches that he had given and turning it into, at that point, I think he was turning it into a collection of essays. It later, on the advice of his agent, became a memoir.
And he completed that?
So we had these very different projects.
And he completed that project?
He got pretty, two months, you don't complete
but
anything.
But eventually, he completed it.
We both got a lot of work done.
Okay, and so you basically switched careers and became a novelist. And did your husband continue writing after that book, or was this just sort of a one-time project for him?
He continued writing, but not in books. He wrote other pieces, but that book was something that he had to write, and he did.
Awesome.
So it was sort of a different path for each of us. But I highly recommend going someplace really amazing and writing full time for whatever. It was an incredible experience to be able to be that immersed in a project.
And then after that, you said you did the MFA.
I did.
The Law Residency MFA. And what were you working on during that time? Was it, again, short stories, or by that point, were you working on a novel?
No, by that point, I had realized that I had already written the first the manuscript of one book, the one that took 20 years for it to grow up enough to be ready for prime time. I went to the MFA because I had realized after writing for a few years that I wanted to write fiction that really dealt with political or socio-political issues without being didactic. And I didn't know how to do it. And I was hoping that I would be able to learn how to do it if I worked with more accomplished writers. And I decided to start on a new novel manuscript to write during the MFA. And that is the book that became my first published novel, House Arrest.
Okay. So tell me the story of how you found a publisher for that novel, for your first novel.
Well, it was serendipity, as I think these things usually are. I quickly got an agent because my husband had an agent, and she was kind enough to look at my manuscript and she liked it. What she said to me from the beginning was, this is probably going to be an indie press book, but I'll give it a try. And so she sent it out to they were the big five back then, publishers, and people liked the writing, but felt that the story was too political too something. The agent basically gave it back to me and said, here, you should be pitching this to indie presses. And I started doing that.
And so you don't need an agent to go to the indie presses?
Not usually. I mean, they certainly read agented material,
right.
Most of them, but they'll also read, manuscripts that are sent to them by a writer. And I think that the reason that they were interested in my book was a coincidence. And that is that first book, one of the main characters lives in an oddball cult. And it turned out that the main editor of the press who I sent it to, one of the presses I sent it to, had grown up in a cult. And that made her interested in at least reading the manuscript. Mm. When you just cold submit something, your hope is that somebody will say, yes, send me the manuscript, I'll read it. From then on, you know, it's whether or not the manuscript is good enough or whether it matches their particular aesthetic. But I think that's why she read it and she accepted it and off we go.
Okay. And then did that same editor publish all your other four books too?
She did indeed.
Did you ever have a contract before you finished writing, or would you write and then submit? And
no, she wouldn't see things until I had as good a draft as I could. But we tended to meet every year at the big AWP conference, Association of Writers and Writing Programs. So we would see each other and have lunch, and I would tell her what I was working on, and she'd say, great, send it to me when it's done. Yeah.
Okay. Now, you talked about the AW, or you mentioned the AWP conference. Are there other conferences that you like to go to that you would recommend?
Well, I'm on the planning committee for an annual writers conference, a one-day conference in Western Massachusetts that called Right Angles. And it's a very, I think it's a wonderful conference. We're working on the 2026 conference now. It'll be in October. The conference I attend every year and that I really, really love going to, that I'm not part of organizing, is the Hobart Festival of Women Writers. And that is held in Hobart, New York, which is in the Western Catskills. It's a three-day conference and with workshops and readings, and it's just, I find it the most welcoming and diverse and inspiring part of my writing year. I love it. It's going to be in June of this year. And if you Google Hobart Festival, it's H-O-B-A-R-T, Hobart Festival of Women Writers. You know, you can see what it's all about. I love it.
And the AWP Festival, what's the focus of that?
That is humongous. It's 3 days. It's many, many thousands of people. It's pretty overwhelming. Mostly there are panels. I think a lot of it focuses on pedagogy and teaching writing. So a lot of writing programs, a lot of academic writing programs are involved. And I don't go every year, but I did go frequently. There's an enormous book fair for any writer who's looking for literary magazines or publishers or just all sorts of writing focused places. And it's enormously educational. And my favorite thing is going to a lot of readings, hearing a lot of writers read, and going to the book fair.
So what's the market like for short stories now? You know, 40 years ago, when I was a little more involved in it, you know, there were some very good magazines that published short stories and paid fairly well for them at the time. Hardly any of those magazines even exist anymore. So what is the market now?
You know, I don't know that much about it now, Monica, because my short stories keep growing into novels. So I rarely send out short stories anymore. I also like to write essays, and I have more experience sending out essays to try to get them published in magazines. There certainly are magazines, you know, magazines that publish short fiction that I like and that I read. Most of them don't pay or don't pay much. You know, I think that the landscape of publishing, unless somebody is a bestseller, it's you're not going to make a living that way.
Yeah. So even with you, with having published six novels over how many years? The first one came out how many years ago?
First one came out in 2011, I think.
Okay. So yeah. 2011. Yeah. So we're talking about 15 years, and that's not a living.
That is not a living. Yeah. That is a passion and a joy, and it is not a living. That the agent who I mentioned earlier once told me that 2% of her clients were able to support themselves writing fiction. That's not impressive, is it?
No, that's of people who have an agent.
Yes.
So,
yeah, exactly.
You know, how many fiction writers actually have an agent? Probably 20%, maybe.
Yeah.
And so 2% of 20% is 0.4%. Wow.
So people teach, and certainly the books that they publish get them the academic jobs.
Right.
And some people do totally different kinds of work to pay the rent, and, you know, and we write because it's enormously satisfying work to do.
So, your essays, tell us some of the places where they've been published.
Essays have been published in really small local magazines. Meat for Tea is one of my favorite small sort of regional magazines, and in bigger places like Literary Hub or the Boston Globe or Ms. Magazine, Lilith. There's a magazine called Mom Egg Review, which I really like, that publish work about women and motherhood and or daughterhood or sort of related fields. You know, I guess every writer has certain places that we tend to go to, places we like. There's another online magazine called Necessary Fiction, which I really like, and I like reading as well as publishing work there from time to time. As the corporate publishers have gotten more and more corporate and, you know, more and more conglomerated, there are more and more small and indie magazines that publish really exciting work that doesn't make a lot of money and doesn't really fit into the corporate world, but is exciting and new and really interesting.
You're listening to Writers' Voices. Our guest today is Ellen Mirapol, author of Sometimes an Island. What is you said when you started writing, because you were sharing a laptop with your husband, you would go back and forth between longhand and computer. Is that still part of your process?
No, I'm pretty much a computer writer now, although I don't have my computer with me all the time. And so I'm constantly scribbling notes. I always have a notebook in my pocket. And if for some reason that's not available, there's always notes on my phone. But so a lot of ideas and scribbles and lines of opening line of an essay or something I'll write longhand. But I guess I have done most of my writing in the age of computers, and that's how I write. You know, a couple of years ago, I bought myself a beautiful leather-bound, thick notebook, thinking, all right, I'm gonna switch from doing all my writing on a computer to writing in this gorgeous notebook, but I haven't even started, because I look at the first blank page and it's such a beautiful piece of work. I haven't written a word there yet.
Well, you know, when I started writing, I had computers, but it was pretty much all by hand to this, you know, back in the 80s. And you know, there was so much, it was so messy. Because you'd write something, then you'd scratch it out, and you'd write something, and then you draw a line. This goes up here, and then you'd have an arrow, and you know, and
yes,
it was so messy, and it's so clean to do all of that kind of editing as you go on a computer, and it was, but I don't know if the brain works quite the same way.
I think you're right. And, you know, I often do revising on a printed hard copy, because I don't know what it is about the way our brains work, but I can, if I have a hard copy, I can see clunkiness much more easily. Of course, hearing it is best. And I often read aloud and say, oh my God, did I really use that word four times in the last paragraph? You know, so there's some things that, you know, but I suspect we're all a little bit different in how our brains kind of deal with and work with the written word on the page or on the screen.
Now, are you a kind of writer who writes very rough first drafts very quickly, or are you someone who kind of edits as you go?
Well, a little bit of both. I'm basically somebody who follows the Kurt Vonnegut school of writing fiction. And he once said that the way to write a novel was to jump off a cliff and develop wings on the way down.
So I love that.
Isn't that a great quote?
Yes.
I love it. I never know where a book is going. So I write the first draft essentially to discover the story. And sometimes I'll go back and rewrite something because what I've discovered means that a whole early section is totally irrelevant or wrong or whatever. But I try to go through and write the first draft entirely from imagination to discover what the story is. Often then I have to do some research. So, you know, my second novel was about torture. And I didn't really know anything about it other than, you know, what I'd seen on Law and Order or something, you know. So I ended up having to do a lot of learning in order to be able to go and write a second draft. But I like writing the first draft just from imagination and realizing that there are big holes I'm going to have to fill with some knowledge I don't have at that moment.
So, Ellen, tell us what the Straw Dog Writers Guild is.
So, Straw Dog Writers Guild is a gathering of writers in Western Massachusetts. We really focus on the four counties of Western Massachusetts. Writers at all levels of development, from brand new to very, very well known. We started it in 2010, when a writing teacher in our area, Patricia Lee Lewis, decided that we needed better networking of writers and gathered three or four of us together to come up with something. And it has been very successful in nurturing new writers, providing literary support for more experienced writers. We hold a lot of free or very low-cost writing programs. We sponsor the Right Angles Writers Conference. We hold several open mics every month, three or four, where writers have a chance to read their work aloud to other people.
Is there a physical location?
No, we don't have a space. We have a part-time staff person and a steering committee and a board of volunteers. We also sponsor a writing residency along with the Mount in Lenox, Massachusetts, for emerging writers. And we have an emerging writer fellowship for writers of color that offers a stipend and some opportunities to really grow as a writer. It's been a major part of my writing life for, you know, however many years that has been. And it's a very, it's a literary home for writers
in
our region.
And can anyone join?
Anybody can join. You know, you can become a member. You can just sign up for the newsletter and get the newsletter. It's been enormously satisfying.
And are some of the meetings online? Some of the events are online?
Some things are online. You know, we've been trying to go back more to in person, but we have a mix. Some of our members don't drive or can't get places or whatever. So we try to have a mix.
Great.
Of online and in person.
Yeah. Well, Ellen, I want to thank you for being with us on Writers' Voices today. I enjoyed reading Sometimes an Island. And we always close with a quote. This was something that when my mother was doing the show with me for many, many years, that was her thing, was finding the closing quote. So I've taken over on that. And I have a quote from Desmond Tutu. 25 years ago, people could be excused for not knowing much about or doing much about climate change. Today, we have no excuse.
That's perfect. Thank you so much for that quote.
You're very welcome. And thank you for being with us. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.